Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, fortnightly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. Happy New Year as well. And today we've got Adam Johnson back with us, who's, you know who Adam Johnson is, but he's Django technical board member, Django author. So you've all got speed up your Django tests, and coming up now soon is improve your Django developer experience, which we're going to talk about today, and various other things. Adam, thank you for coming on the show again.
Thank you very much, and Happy New Year to you both.
Happy New Year to you, sir.
Carlton, you missed one. Adam just won the Malcolm Trednick Memorial Prize.
Yes, he did.
Which is well deserved. I voted for you. And I would just say the two top vote getters are the two of you this year. So it was a very, very easy choice for the board.
No, thank you.
That's good.
Congratulations. Very well deserved.
Yeah. Thank you, Adam. Yeah, well done, Adam. Like, you're massive. You're doing posts all the time. You're putting out packages after packages after packages. You're always there on the mailing lists, you know, giving people the welcome pointers. So super.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm honored to receive the prize, and it came in the worst year of my life. So it's a nice end. It helped me a lot.
Okay.
We have lots to talk about. I think it's going to be a lot of the two of you talking, but I would love to tee up the Django Technical Board. Maybe we could tell folks what that is and what they do, since Adam, you're on it, and that's quite a big deal. It's also a relatively new thing, and how that works with the Django code base for new releases since 4.0 came out just a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm.
Sure. So the technical board is five members voted in for each release cycle, where the buck stops with decisions on whether things go into Django or not. Like, quite often, like, features are clearly like a good idea, so it's okay for a few people to suggest it and the fellows to go and review. But for larger scale changes or contentious changes, a technical board vote would be held, and we'd need a consensus whether or not something would be added.
Yeah, so if it was an easy decision, it would not reach the board. In the same way for community, that's what the Django Software Foundation handles, non-technical things, but the DSF has no sway over the technical board decisions by design.
Yeah, exactly.
I should know. Does that go to the long-term releases, or is that the number releases?
It's every number
release. Is it 2.2 to 3.2, or is it?
So I've been on the technical board since 2.2, voted in each time since. There's like maybe 8 or 9 people who've stood over that time. So most people who are standing are getting elected at least once. It's just kind of cycling between a few people, I think.
It's kind of interesting that, because, I mean, one comment was made on the Django Software Foundation DSF members list that the election's not hasn't been particularly diverse, and that it's all, you know, it's all white men still. And part of that, I think, is because we still have quite a narrow experience contributor base. Like, mm-hmm. the qualification for the technical boards, you have to be involved in the day-to-day running. I mean, you don't have to have been there forever, but you do have to be active on the discussion list and things like this. And we still don't have a very broad contributor base there, so there's not necessarily a wider pool to draw from, which is something we kind of think about. But
it's definitely something that would be nice to correct. It's very hard because you have to have been contributing for years before you're really eligible to be on the technical board. You have to have some deep knowledge of various parts. So,
and of course, that's correct, right? Like,
so there's a tension.
It's chicken and egg.
Well, the DSF doesn't have that requirement. So, you can don't even have to be an individual member to be voted on, though it is voted on by the individual members. So you do need to be known in the community. And all those things are true. I think one thing I found this past year, I think it's basically for the first time since I've been on the board, this is my third year, we had basically all the same people reelected. And diversity is nice. I mean, I'm not planning to stay indefinitely, but it is easier logistically to have the same people, because certainly for 2 years terms, because you kind of know how to do things. Whereas initially that first couple of months, people are ramping up. So my second year, there was like half the board was new. And so a lot of time was spent kind of getting people up to speed. So anyways, internal baseball, but maybe longer term, there is something I think to multi-year terms just to kind of avoid the ramp up and ramp down. But at the same time, a recycling of voices is healthy as well.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure about this. There's Django release every 8 months. Is it every major release cycle now? So it's every 8 months or every 2.5 years for the technical board?
I thought it was every 8 months.
Right.
Because it was 2.2 okay. I was voted in on, and now I was in the 4.0. Yeah.
I was kind of talking to Maris about this. Do we need a new election?
It's a ceremony that goes past very quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, 8 months is too quick, I think.
Well, I think, the DSF board, a year is, if I had total control, I think is too quick too. I think there's something to, perhaps a, 3 out of 3.2 or 2-3 year term, just to avoid the nuisance, because it does take up quite a bit of time. Anyways, yeah. Something for all of us to discuss with our our bodies.
So we should give a couple of examples of things the technical board done. So not quite often we discuss on the mailing list, and we just come to a consensus, right?
Yep.
And it's but there are a few issues. So one that has been really important for was a discussion about typing, because there was no consensus at all, and there was a DEP, and there was massive discussion on the mailing list, and there was maybe even been draft PR, I don't know. But Maris and I just aren't in a position where we can go, we decide to merge this, or we decide to close this. So we asked the technical board for that, and you were involved in that discussion then.
Yes, that was a big one. And we came to the conclusion that Django wouldn't add type hints at the time. And that was like a couple of years ago at this point. And obviously typing has moved forwards as many of us have gained a bit more experience. So it would be nice to reapproach that decision at some point.
Yeah.
The second point is who's going to do the work, because it would be a lot of work to add the type hints into Django.
Yeah. I mean, so you've been blogging loads and loads about, types. Would it be fair to say that, you'd be keen now to think again about adding those?
Yeah, I think I'd probably be in favor, but we'd probably have to come to a decision that we'd only officially support MyPy or something like that, because you will need a plugin for a type checker to tell it, when you make a Django model, the field definitions map onto these types.
Okay. One thing that I've been flirting around is around the widget API, because, there's lots of areas there where it's like, what exactly do I get out of value for Datadict here? And, I could really appreciate some typing there, but my kind of thought is, I wonder if we could do this just in, say, the widgets file, just in one kind of module where it's at the kind of leaf, the widgets don't really impinge on anything else. They're not impinged by anything else. Could we type those? And that might be a sort of progressive way of doing it. I don't know.
Yeah, progressive would be how I'd like to see it happen anyway. All these leaf modules, like all the things in Django utils, they'd be perfect candidates to begin with. But we'd need to discuss, is there value in adding just a small amount of type hints initially, or is that going to make it harder for people? Because then they're going to have, we're trying to use the type hints, but everything else is showing up as any and causing us headaches.
Yeah.
Some research is definitely required.
Yeah, okay. Interesting.
Something else technical I'd love to mention. So as I went to bed last night, I saw there's a new security release. And this morning I see in the notes, Adam, you've done up a whole blog post on it, which is insane. So I wonder if we could briefly talk about that. And that's a chance to mention that you're also on the security team of Django, which is a separate group.
Yeah, for a few months now.
And a few months?
I think Carlton invited me in September, something like that.
Oh, wow. Well, I just assumed you were part of it the last couple of years.
Let me just give a bit of background there. There's about 10 members, some of the more up, the older contributors that have been around for, and they're super knowledgeable, but not necessarily involved in Django day-to-day anymore. And, there's a few people who are still very active, like Marcus Holtzman and Florian Apollina. But we were finding that, it was me and Maris and maybe Marcus and maybe Florian commented, and we just needed some more people who would sort of directly involved kind of very regularly. And so amongst the security team, we talked about it with Adam, and Nick Pope came up. And so we invited both of them, and they came in. And they've been super helpful and active, because we get a lot, not a lot of reports. How many reports would you say we get, Adam, in you?
I'd say the average is one every 2 weeks that's really actionable. Would you say that's about it? Yeah.
I mean, it's not a lot, but they all need dealing with. They all need looking at. And it's not easy. It's really not easy. You know, I mean, I'm not a security expert, and a thing comes in and it's like, I don't know, is this, and without the security team, there's no way I could handle those, you know, those issues. Like, I mean, yeah, okay, some of them it's easy. No, that's not a problem. Some of them, oh yeah, that clearly is. But then there's this vast area of, that's a really difficult question.
I think I really like seeing how everyone like filled in the holes of knowledge and ideas in solving these issues. Yeah, because we'd have a lot of back and forth before even a pull request is opened, to be like, oh, we could do this, we could do that. And yeah, so there were three fixes in today's release, right?
Yeah.
Shall we run through them quickly? Okay, so the first one was a denial of service possibility in user attribute similarity validator. Now that's a mouthful, isn't it? That's a password validator that checks that the password given isn't too similar to a user's other attributes, like their email address. So they're not just recycling their email address or adding a one and exclamation mark at the end for their password.
Yeah, who does that?
I think quite a lot of people.
That's exactly what I do.
Yeah, so it's active by default when you do start project. Who was it that reported that one? Chris Bailey reported that if you submit a very large password, then it has a kind of n squared or exponential runtime. I'm not sure which. You have to submit like a very large password, like 100,000 characters, but then that can lead to like many seconds of processing on an average server. And you know, submitting 100,000 letter A's over gzip is not much of a request body for the client to send. But then it can result in many seconds of processing, so it becomes like a denial of service vector. Someone submitting loads of these requests could cause your server just to hang up. So the fix that I came up with along with Florian, Colton, and Marius is to avoid checking the similarity if the password is like so much longer than the attribute value that it's not going to be regarded as similar anyway.
So how do you come to that conclusion, right? I mean, are you like, did you come up with that, or is that something that other security researchers have used as a best practice?
We had to come up with this one. I don't think there's much groundwork for using this kind of algorithm out there.
I mean, this was quite an interesting example, because Adam had an idea to just, well, you know, if we we'll take it, like if it's a plural, you know, a multiple, sufficient multiple, cut it off. And then there was various back and forth and different approaches. And it was really nice. This is Adam's point about like everyone throwing in their ideas, was that there were two or three different takes, and it's like, yeah, actually this one's quite sweet. And you know, it's a nice ratio that this is a realistic cutoff at different scales of input and whatnot.
Cool. And then there's two more.
Okay, we'll go through them a little quicker because I'm a bit less familiar.
Yeah.
The second one was with the dict sort template filter. This is one that I've not seen used, but it takes a list of dictionaries and then sorts them by a key or perhaps an attribute. Security researcher at Sonosource, Dennis Brinkrolf, submitted us a report that you can use it to access like arbitrary attributes. And inside of a string, you can access the characters of the string one by one. So if a user managed to submit which order to sort your list of dictionaries by, they could sort them by character 0, then character 1, then character 2, and see the sort order changing, and then they could infer the value of that attribute. And if that value was like security sensitive, like a password or API key, they can kind of infer, okay, this user appeared at the top of the list, so their password starts with A. And then when I sort by character 2, they're in the middle of the list, so that's probably something around L. And then I can kind of combine that with other info to get a statistical guess at what their what their secret value is.
Yeah, I like you phrased it in your blog post, a good example of don't repeat yourself causing problems. I think that's...
Yeah, because the problem came from the filter reused the Django variable class, probably over time variable gained more abilities, and then
right.
that has led to the ability to index characters in a string and do this sorting, whereas it was never advertised for doing that, and probably no one needs that.
Well, I think that the more common example of this, right, is with URLs, where why you would use a UUID. So instead of going user / one, or right, because as you said, it could apply to bank records or something important. You don't want someone to infer the order or the number. And then number three, I can read it. So there's a potential directory traversal via storage .save class, which, so that's a file storage API thing.
Yeah. So when you're uploading a file.
Well, I think it's just, it's interesting to talk about this because, you know, I think like many, I see the reports that come out and I'm just like, yeah, that sounds good to me. And unless it's something I directly have, don't get a chance to fully dive into it or even know the process behind it. So
yeah, and these file directory traversal ones, there's been several of those over the throughout the, you know, the upload handlers and then, and you know, blah blah blah, and there was a number, and this is kind of like the last one, and you'd have to use the storage directly, which kind of nobody does, so it's already been bulletproofed around the outside. But the idea would be that, you know, you go from the media file, the media directory where you're meant to be saving it, to somewhere else on the file system, which, you know, you're not supposed to have access. Now, you know, if you do everything right, that can't, you know, that's already ruled out by various other bits in Django. But, you know, this is the sort of last bolt down on that area. There might be a bit of a rewrite coming in the future. Who knows?
Saying it's the last possible directory traversal bug is very brave, Carlton.
Well, no, in that little bit. It's the last possible one in that cluster of, you know, that cluster of upload handlers and files, and because we've gone over them. No doubt there'll be one next week.
I think there's been like sufficient eyeballs on it now. It's pretty good. This was again by Dennis Brinkroff and Sonosource. So I guess they were running some kind of scanner or just deciding to audit open source projects. So yeah, they found it. That was cool.
Well, something else, just to shed light on all the things you do, Adam, just PRs to Django itself. So 4.0 came out. I guess, Carlton, this was in your week notes thing where I saw where, I don't think it was on the release notes, where you listed all the active contributors. And Adam, you were one of the largest ones. We'll link to that. It's not in the release notes, right? I don't think the formal.
No. So what I've got for 4.0 is a breakdown of new contributors, of people who, like, I've called them on a roll, people who contributed in 3.2 as well, and then people who didn't contribute in 3.2 but had previously, and could put those in the category of welcome back. And what I want to do is write that up and then put that somewhere, either on my site or on djangoproject.com if we can find a suitable place for it, and then keep that rolling for 4.1 and as we go forward. That would have happened already if it weren't for, you know, 2020 or the usual excuses. But that's coming. And the idea there is just to have a bit of fun calling out contributors and to, you know, particularly for new contributors, you make a contribution. Can we find a way of just flagging up? And, you know, it was on my list to get done for the end of the year and that just didn't happen. So, okay, over the next month or so, I'll pull it up and, you know, finish that off and have that going forward. But that the idea there is to do something to call out contributors a little more than we have, you know. It's just a bit of fun.
It's important, though. I think it's important to highlight those things, you know.
I think it's important because of exactly this problem of diversity we've already talked about just now. Like, it's all right if you're sort of economically privileged and blah, blah, blah. You can contribute to, loads of time to open source, and you can spend the time to get a contributor record, and, you know, but if a lot of people, they need some recognition for it to, you know, so I've made one contribution, did that pay back to me? Well, no, it didn't, because it just disappeared into the void. Whereas if we can put it on a website somewhere and then they can point to it, it adds a little, you know, for someone getting into tech, it adds a validation point that might help them get a job, and then they think, oh, you know, I can contribute, you know, I can continue. We need to do things to smooth the pathway there, or we're never going to change the situation we're in. It's always going to be a slow break. We're not going to, you know, instantly have a super diverse contributor base. But if we don't do these things, we're never going to have that contributor base.
Well, part of it, Adam, I mean, because even just your commits to Django, there's a wide range of how how big they are, right? Like, I think you tweeted there was one, a template, like it's like a one line thing with you and Marius, you know, and then you have, you know, signal receiver function stuff, you know, so there's, I think it's great that you highlighted that because that's something where it seems small, but like that's exactly an onboarding way versus going into like a core piece of Django and thinking that's what it takes to do a PR.
Right. Yeah. This one line change, I just was reading the docs. I found that there's a class that exists, but the setting that you'd put that class in didn't document it. It said, here's the list of built-in and listed two of the three. So it's just adding the third one on that list. And I think there are like a number of these small things out there you might spot when reading the docs. And it's great to just go make that change. So it helps everyone else in the future.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, I mean, I know you're a consultant and so you poke around in a lot of code bases. Like, how do you find so many things? I mean, because I guess I'm just not using Django to the full bore the way you are. But I mean, the range of PRs you have, you know, SQLite, signals, templates. I mean, is it client work? Is it a docs mismatch? Or is there any pattern there? Because you find so many.
Yeah, I guess I just end up going through a bunch of different stuff, trying to solve people's problems they bring to me. I also enjoy reading the code. And I'll sometimes take that as first reference, even skipping the docs when I'm like, oh, what's that method on the storage, for example? I have Django open in a Sublime text window all the time. Yeah, I guess the third thing is I'm always just finding it fun and expanding my knowledge and my curiosity by diving into things I'm not really looked at before. So like SQLite, I was just interested in SQLite a bit more because they came out with that new release that SQLite has strict tables now. I was like, oh, I wonder how good Django's SQLite support really is, and could you get that strict thing in there? And then when I was reading the database backend, I came up with that optimization PR. I was like, oh, this seems fun. I could do it.
I love that.
And Nick Pope was very good at reviewing and getting and helping me out there.
So I while we've got you, while we're talking about the ORM and contributing, so you're one of my sort of go-to ORM knowledgeable people, you know, that I can flag up on a PR. Hey, Adam, can you look at this? You know, obviously you did all the work on Django MySQL and, you know, you've been contributing there for a long time. One of the questions we always have from prospective new contributors is, how do I get going contributing to the ORM? So can I put that question to you? What would be your kind of initial thoughts if somebody's coming, you know, somebody wants to get involved and they want to get involved in the ORM specifically?
That's a hard one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think the problem with the ORM is that like it does like 99.9% of all the queries people need, but most developers probably only know how to write like 99% of those. So there's this kind of ton of extra features that are hard to discover, and some people might be tempted to just try and help, but it's already there in some way. Yeah, I don't know if there's an easy path into the ORM. I know there's like a James Bennett 3-hour talk at a DjangoCon that is like a deep dive into the ORM. And it's a few years ago, but the fundamentals won't have changed. If you can sit through that, you're definitely going to be a good ORM contributor.
I've tried 3 times. I still really want to. It's no slag on him. It's just, it gets deep fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bit of a trial by fire.
Maybe that's a New Year's resolution for me.
Okay, cut one slightly different angle then. You said there are lots of features that are kind of hard to discover. So, like, you know, do you think there's a bit of a doc shortage in terms of learning more advanced SQL features or SQL features and how to use them with the ORM, like annotations and aggregations and then the expressions API and, you know, all those, you know, output field types and blah, 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 all that stuff, which is, it's documented, but there's no real easy learning path for that, I would think.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I've liked and tried to promote a bit is check constraints. I've done a number of posts on that. If you read the check constraint docs in Django, they are like purely a reference. They're not going to explain to you what a check constraint really is and how it's defined on the database. And we don't really have like a topic guide there. So if someone was looking for a topic guide, that'd be a good place to start. Perhaps that's a good first ORM contribution. It's like in migrations, we have the reference for all the different operations and the topic guide of like how to do X in migrations is actually where you can learn how to really use that stuff. Like that has a few topics now, but could definitely be expanded. So like, how do you add an index concurrently? Like, we have that now for Postgres, in Django Contrib Postgres, but there's definitely not a topic guide like, here's what you should be doing to use it.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's all these features, but yeah.
Carlton, it seems I have a lot of questions. I don't want to overrun you. Do you?
No.
Okay.
No,
I wanted to ask, so your new book, was it Boost Your Django Developer Experience? Is that's the title?
Yep.
You've
Boost Your Django DX or Developer Experience.
So you've, I've seen you, I don't know if it's on Twitter or your blog post, mention like book-driven development so could you talk a bit about that? Because you've put out, I mean, we have a long list in the notes, so many projects, posts, but as you've been writing the book, so I'm really interested in that, and if you could expand on that topic.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book is just trying to describe and like categorize all the tools that aren't Django itself, but like live around it, that can really help you like accelerate your development. And I guess book-driven development is where I start writing a section. I'm like, okay, I think I know the best way that I've seen to do this. And I get halfway, I'm like, actually, you know, that I'm just describing some snippets that you could copy-paste. Instead, it would be better if there was a package out there that would combine all this for you. So like a good example there is a Django Rich, a package I just created to integrate Will McGugan's Rich that does nice terminal output with Django. Currently, it only provides like a new management command. Yes, Carlton?
Is there a test runner coming for that? Because a while ago, there was a PR to get colored output into the Django test runner, and it didn't make it because of maintainability concerns, but perhaps a third-party package wrapping Rich as a test runner, that'd be a nice thing to see.
It would be a nice thing to see. I did briefly look into it and was like, maybe the package could do this. But a unit test is really the blocker there, because you've got to override this class and that class. Django's text test results and its debug results inherit from the text results. There's like a chain of like four classes that refer to each other in subclass. And it would be a pain.
Okay, interesting.
I think maybe an approach would be if there was a unit test extension package that used Rich, then Django could inherit off that.
Okay.
If it was there. The Rich package only provides a management command that gives you the way to wrap Django's output with Rich and then turn it off if you're piping to a terminal, another terminal command.
And what about the Django browser reload? I mean, that was one that I know came out, and I guess asking the two of you, you know, is that a future core Django thing, or what are there just clear limitations on that? Because that's pretty helpful.
Sure. Briefly, Django browser reload is a tool that you install, and then in development, whenever you hit save on a template or save on a Python file that causes the server to restart or a static asset changes, then it will hit reload on the browser for you automatically. It does this with a different approach to what I've seen before, in that it sets up a very small like JavaScript-based listener in the browser that's listening for a stream of events from a Django view that captures them, and then that JavaScript worker, it hits reload on the most recently opened tab that you have for your development server. So if you've opened five of them, it's only going to reload one. I was inspired to do this because I was writing about DX. I knew that this is a big problem. Like, people have this in JavaScript. They have like even the hot replacement where the page doesn't reload. It just swaps in one section. But there's not really been something I've seen in Django that works amazingly. I came across one package, I think, for Fast API, and this was using Selenium to control it. And I was like, there's got to be a simpler way. I don't want to force everyone to install Selenium and use a Selenium development browser to do this. There's got to be a way in JavaScript. And yeah, it didn't take long to fumble through the JavaScript APIs and come up with something very basic.
That's great. No, that's really interesting. That is a common problem, and that's an elegant approach, which I guess time will tell, but I don't know why it wouldn't work.
It would be cool to have it in core.
That's the interesting question, is what makes it in, what doesn't, and, you know, I mean.
Yeah, I would like to know in what situations it doesn't work before we really go ahead and consider it.
It's the sort of thing that's suitably useful that there's a case to be made, right?
Well, I suppose, I mean, and there's almost, I don't know if it's a conflict of interest, but if it's your own package and you're on the technical board and the security team, it's not really on you to propose that it be integrated. But I guess when it's a third-party package, you know, people can use it on their own, and if there are issues, they'll come to the fore.
So many times we have like the standard argument, the standard line, the standard approach is, can we get this feature into Django? Well, can you put it into a third-party package, and can we see how that goes for, you know, quite a long time? I mean, you know, Django REST framework is 15 years, 10 years out there. You know, it can live in a third-party package forever. And so what's the case for bringing it in? You know, that's, you know, Django Tbug Toolbar, that would be a, you know, candidate, but that's never going to get merged into core. You know, these kind of hyper-useful third-party packages, they can just stay as third-party packages. I don't know. But we can't just go, right, new feature, bam.
Can I ask some more about the book? I mean, sort of, I've had a chance to look at it, as has Carlton, but, you know, topics covered, because this is your second book. You also have your Speed Up Your Django Tests, and the book will be released a couple days after this comes out. So we'll have a link. Everyone should can they still pre-order it up until the release?
You can pre-order it right up until the hour it's released. It'll be released at 12 noon GMT. That's the same as UTC right now, on the 10th of January.
Okay, well, this will come out. We're recording on the 4th. It'll come out on the 5th, so we'll have a big prominent link to that. But anyways, yeah, to the book. So what was, you know, because I find the question is always what not to include, right? Because the first draft is like, let me just dump everything in, and then it's like what to strip out, and then it's like, okay, and is this actually what I want to say? As you were, you know, with these areas, you start to give it a beginner's look with some experience, and then sometimes you come up with different approaches.
Yeah, so I tried writing one chapter for each kind of like broad area of the development of a Django application. So it starts off with like looking at docs, and then how you make virtual environments and manage dependencies, and it goes on to other things. Like later it's things that are actually in your code, like your settings and models and migrations. So yeah, it's about everything that's like alongside the actual writing of Django code. There's not much like, here's how to build an X in Django, but it's here's how to make it faster for you to build X in Django. So faster and more bug-free. You're very right about cutting things. There's so many things that are actually involved in the process. One thing that's helped me a lot is I added a dropped file in the repo with all the topics that I've dropped in bullet point. That could have been like a whole chapter on Git, a whole chapter on GitHub,
yeah,
whole chapter on text editors.
Yeah, I have all these ghost chapters too.
Yeah, I have to ignore it.
Well, it's a combination of, yeah, it's like, oh, this is hard, or like the deadline, and you're like, yeah, if it's important, I mean, I had a whole huge thing on logging for my professionals book, and I'd still like to put it in there, but I was also like, oh, I just got to ship it.
Logging could be its own book.
Well, right.
Similarly, like I in this book, I say, hey, you could go install MyPy. And then it's like, I can't cover type hints here. There's no real way of even starting. So here's just some links to resources.
I mean, there's a question, because you did this whole series of posts on typing. I did wonder if that was kind of, you know, blogging the first draft of, there was going to be a typing book come out of that, but
I've considered it. I wrote those for my own education, as well as to like help push typing a bit, because it should be possible, I think, to like search how do I do type hints for this Python feature and find a reasonable explanation. So I just try to cover many of these bases, and I think a book would just be like a bundle of these posts that you could go read,
like a cookbook,
on your e-reader.
Typing cookbook.
Oh, maybe that's the title.
Well, I love that you're doing these, you know, not just advanced, but related to Django, but not Django itself approach. I feel like that's maybe an approach I should have done, because I struggle more with the my more advanced books than the beginner one. Because the beginner one, I feel a little more confident saying, I don't need to dive into everything. Like, just sort of trust me on this, or, you know, here's how you can go deeper. But the more advanced ones, it's still kind of the same thing, but it's harder to do. I feel a little worse about waving my hands, or maybe I'm just not as clear on it. And I'd have to say, you know, okay, here's three ways to do it. I like this one, but I don't feel the same level of confidence on that as I would on a beginner thing where it's like, hey, we're just going to backfill a little bit here. So I'm incredibly impressed that you're, I mean, of course you have the background to write these books, but I feel in some ways they're harder to write, but taking a more from the side, you know, not just doing like the most badass Jenga project ever approach, like that's a recipe for failure. That's like building a Jenga puzzle, which is what I have in my professionals book. So don't do that.
Well, I'm trying to fill in the gaps of what materials out there. It's very easy to say to someone, hey, go set up pre-commit. And then like the pre-commit docs don't say, here's how to do pre-commit on a Python project with Flake 8, iSort, and Black. Whereas that's what most people want. That's what Django does. There could be some opinion. I do respect your books, Will. And I think the fact that you're a bit uncertain about what's going into the professionals book is just an indication of it being senior, right? At senior, you have to make trade-offs.
Yeah. It all depends. That'll be my fourth book. Right, Carlton? We'll list all the unknowables.
I think your point about pre-commit is a good one. Like, because you go to the pre-commit docs, you're like, okay, it can take all day to get it set up properly. Whereas you give the recipe, look here, bam, this is how you get pre-commit going in your Django project quickly. So one thing I wanted to ask you about, because you seemed to manage so many open source projects, and part of that, surely it must be, tell me, is that you've got this tooling kind of lined up to automate the repetitive parts of managing a package. Is that right?
Absolutely. I use a tool called MyRepos, which I guess is a bit weird because it's written in Perl and it's not always so easy to use. But it lets you like run commands in multiple directories. It's Git aware, so it has like a status command if you need that. So I kind of treat all my open source packages as one large repo with like some variability in each of them if necessary, but as little as possible. So if there's a new Python version, what I'll do is actually write a script that will make the appropriate changes in the right files using SD. That's a Rust-based replacement for sed. And so I just run my repos and run that script and I'll do the in all those files. So as long as everything stays relatively uniform, I can upgrade, you know, 33 packages, I think it is now, in the same time that many people could do one or two.
So it's like boost your GitHub DX?
Yeah, I guess.
That's a great question. I was wondering the same thing. I'm trying to like nuke open source repositories I have because I just can't deal with maintaining them. And so I love seeing that you're going the other way. I mean, your output, honestly, it just makes me tired, but I think I'm just tired of little kids, but I'm just like, oh my God, like every, you know, cause your weekly posts, which people should sign up for, it's like, oh, couple packages, couple blog posts, couple core commits, you know, plus everything else I do. It's awesome. It's honestly, it gives me energy though to see that you can be so prolific.
I'm glad
with this stuff.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you about one more package, which is Django Upgrade. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that's.
Oh yeah. That's very exciting. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's worth mentioning. So I wrote this between August and September. It's a code rewriter that. Will upgrade your Django syntax, and it knows about some changes as far back as 1.10 because they were there. Bruno Alla wrote a version of this before called Django Code Mod, and this used Instagram's libcst, which is their concrete syntax tree library. There are a couple problems with that underlying library though. First, it's like incredibly slow because it's a Python parser written in Python, and it also like turns features on and off depending upon Python version, so it's like got all these branches. And then the second would be that they don't really update it for new Python versions. Instagram is still running their own fork of 3.8 as I understand, so there's 3.9 and 3.10 syntax that's just not supported. So the end result is that Django Code Mod is like okay for most people, but it's not something you can add in the way that I like it, which is, you know, it runs through on your pre-commit hook. So you never can commit old syntax. It will just get rewritten when you try. So Django Upgrade is like a rewrite of Django code mod, but it's using the same approach that a tool called PyUpgrade uses. PyUpgrade just uses the built-in Python syntax tree and tokenizer to figure out what changes to make. Django Upgrade does the same thing. So if you're running it on Python 3.10, it automatically supports all the features in 3.10 because the Python standard library will support
those. I've had a little play with that AST stuff. It's quite sort of in-depth. Mm-hmm. It's quite slow going, I'd say.
It was very entertaining to learn a bit more about it. And especially the... especially the going back from the AST to the tokens, because when you're at the token level, you're basically manipulating like this thing. All we know about it is it looks like a name. We don't know what it relates to in the actual source tree. Is it a variable name or a class name and assignment? So yeah, you're fiddling around with those tokens. It's quite fun.
Okay, so I have great hopes for Django Upgrade in that one of the big one of the great strengths of Django is the stability policy for the API stability policy. Then we don't break stuff unless, you know, there's a good reason to do so. And I was asking on Twitter today after the release, I was like, you know, because I was releasing 2.2 as well as 3.2 and 4.0. And I was like, who's still on 2.2? Like, what, you know, because I don't use the LTS myself. And I tweeted out, and it's a, you know, agency, a couple of big agencies. So Dab Apps, Jamie replied, and then Tobias from Cactus replied, saying, you know, well, we use it because our clients, it's very hard to justify the 8-monthly upgrade, whereas the sort of 2-yearly upgrade, we can do that. And other replies were like, look, it's stability. We use the LTS for stability. And one of the big challenges is, oh, we want to deprecate this, but people won't be able to upgrade. And, you know, when we changed, I don't know, to using, you had to import the view rather than just use the string view name. I think, you know, actually we lost Instagram over that change. You know, they weren't prepared to go through. And so they forked Django and, you know, they're forever on a forked Django now rather than on mainstream Django. And maybe they'd have gone anyway. But could we avoid that? And well, one hope of avoiding that kind of breaking changes automatic script. So when we do introduce a deprecation, there's also a matching script that will go through your code base and correctly update it. Is that a pipe dream too far, or is that realistic hope that we might have?
Well, I definitely share this hope. It's one thing to like deprecate it and add a warning, and then that warning just shows up in your test suite. It's like, here's 1,000 things to go change. It's like, that's no fun. So yeah, there's definitely a place for this. I'd be excited to see it going forwards. I couldn't spot anything in 4.0 that can actually be automatically rewritten without huge amounts of effort. So definitely a balancing act. There's plenty of changes in 4.0 that we can't automate without.
So here's a tester for you for 4.1. Like we brought in the zone info, time zone changes for Django 4.0. And there's this django.utils.timezone.utc constant, which is just, we should get rid of that ideally. But that's everywhere. And so is it worth the check? We could just leave it there forever. But if we are going to get rid of it, we need to get rid of it before 5.0, because it needs to go at the same time as PyTZ. So, you know, could we use PyUpgrade to make A, deprecate that, remove it, but B, make removing it, you know, just run a script. That would be a cool thing.
That one's definitely easy to change from the AST's perspective, because you can see it being imported and you can be like, okay, what do we replace it with? And I guess we just replace it with the one in Python's datetime module, right?
Yeah, so exactly that. It's just replace it with datetime.utc. But like it would be nice, because my only reticence about removing it is that it's everywhere. You know, everywhere in the ecosystem, people have been using that. So if there was a script that came along with Django 5.0 that said, hey, you've got to remove this, but just run this and it's done. That would be an amazing, proof of concept of that this is the future of upgrading Django, because stability, right? That's the USP.
Yep, Definitely. And there's a good argument to remove it, right? Because it looks like it's a different thing. And once it's just an alias for Python's one, all you've got is like the potential for confusion.
Yeah. So why are we keeping it? We're keeping it to avoid the churn, but
That confusion can stay there forever in tutorials People's code base snippets that get copy pasted. Oh, I should be using Django's one. Oh, no, it's exactly the same. It's just an alias.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
One thing I found in Django Upgrade is some historical changes where there were aliases for Python built-in functions that have been rewritten. And they weren't ever documented, but when they were removed, I found the old commits and people were debating, should we really be doing this? And we're definitely better off that we did now. So.
Okay, interesting. So we should push that for 5.0 then.
It's been decided here on the podcast.
It's a quorum, yeah. So the book's coming out. At least for me, there's always, it's not like a downer after something comes out, but there's sort of like a loss of purpose. At the same time, there's like a, oh, thank God, like I can worry about something else. So long term, what else? Do you know what, to work on projects, books, like Pie in the Sky, things you have planned around Django?
Well, I've taken a break from client work since July last year, so I'll be getting back into that. And no doubt diving through people's code bases, I'll spot some new things that I'm interested in changing.
Yeah.
For the book, my next writing project will be to go update the speed up your Django tests one for 4.0.
Yeah, I got you on 4.0. You got me on 3.2, but I got you on 4.0. For one of my books. I'm still still waiting on the other one. But yeah, when I pushed that, I was just like, I double checked. I was like, I beat Adam in something.
Congrats.
It's not a big change. It's a pretty small change.
Yeah, that's...
Or at least I think for yours as well. It's not, I don't think, trying to remember.
I'm lucky that my books aren't like, go run exactly these things and it will definitely work for you. They're more like, hey, this is something that could work.
Oh my God. It's a test of something, because I get emails and they're like, there's an error, and I'm like, are you using the right code? Did you pin your repositories? Like, I am 99.9% sure you're making a mistake, but I just like, sometimes I have to just like wait a couple of days and be like, you sure you want to check? So it's good and bad. It's like, I'm pretty sure I'm right on this, because I've put it in this little box. But anyways, you don't have those. It's a little, I envy the like, yeah, like you could do this. Like, it might work for you.
So
when I go through my updates, like I've thought of running a script to like check everything, but I also for now manually go through everything, as much for like the text part, because I just kind of whinge when I read old things I've written and I'm like, oh, I could rephrase that or improve it. So it's like a forced update mechanism. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's what you do, if you go through and read the text, or you probably have a test suite you can run and just see what's broken.
You think too much for me. I definitely go through and read things. In speed up your Django tests, at least, because some features were still under development, I signposted, hey, in Django 4.0, you'll be able to do this. So there would just be a matter of updating it and checking that what I wrote there is still applicable.
Yeah, I do that too. Yeah, I try to say, I think this is coming. But I mean, also, I think, it's good to have some distance from it, right? I mean, 8 months is hard. Which this is the first, last year is the first time I missed an update cycle, but it's almost too close, because you sort of need some distance and things change to like revisit the same stuff. Anyways, yeah, that makes sense. I wish you well on the update challenge. It's like a band playing their greatest hits is how I look at it. It's like some for me, like new stuff, and then some for everyone else, which is updating things I've already written.
Greatest hits. I like that analogy.
Yeah, it's like, if nobody cared, I wouldn't do it. So. Anyways, not to make this about writing books, Carlton. I know you love those discussions.
No. It's just, I like them because they remind me not to do it.
Anyways, we should wrap up.
Okay, let's wrap up there. Adam, thank you so much for coming on. Good luck with the book launch. Everybody, remember, you can pre-order until the 10th. Boost your Django DX.
10% discount.
Well, there you are. Thanks for coming on, and thanks for everything you do to the Django for the Django community, and well done again on the Malcolm Trendelik Award. Couldn't think of someone who deserves it more.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, everyone, we are back on our every 2 week schedule with new episodes on DjangoChat.com and ChatDjango on Twitter, and we'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.